Class war.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
That's my attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When a system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is your brother, Brian Mirandese. Welcome to this Class War Benefit Podcast episode. So, I've been trying to figure out how I'm going to go about doing this thing with COVID-19, man. I've recorded a couple of episodes, didn't like them, scrapped them. You know, I'm trying to bring something to you guys that's going to be different and unique. Sagar and Jetty, the conservative misfit of Crystal Balls Rising. I mean, it's really Crystal Ball and him, but he kind of gave me a view on what I wanted to do and what I wanted to at least start off discussing with you guys when it came to COVID-19. We are experiencing, obviously, some very bad problems with getting healthcare supplies to healthcare workers. Just so happens I actually work in the healthcare industry, but I don't work with patients, which I'm very glad of right now. My brother, who is a nurse, actually does obviously work with patients. But Sagar and Jetty mentioned that one of the problems of our modern capitalist society is this idea of, I think it's called production on demand, which is pretty much that you keep as little stock as possible in your warehouse, and as people order things, you ramp up production to meet what they're ordering. Now, logically, this saves a lot of money, and it does. But illogically, when you need the capacity to produce a lot, like right now, that limits what you are able to do. But actually, I think he's correct. There's two aspects of this which I don't even think he is familiar with. The first one is back in the early 1900s, you knew I was going to take it back, right? That's what I do. I take it back. The major issue confronting capitalists, industrialists is what they called them back then, was overproduction. Overproduction. They had not figured out a way to force people into compulsory consumption, compulsory buying. This is the early 1900s, late 1800s, before marketing and manipulation of people's emotions got to such an extent that it drove people to want to buy for no reason. They had not figured out how to get people to not only consume compulsively, but also for them to want to consume or even need to consume compulsively. See, because it's one thing to get a person to buy a compulsionary item, but it's another thing to make them feel like they need to do it beyond them wanting to do it. Back in those days, early 1900s, people still had a appreciation for value. They still had an appreciation for value. And so they wanted something that was not only going to last, but in all likelihood would be able to be passed on to another generation, if not see the generation that bought it originally to their grave. In other words, when people made purchases like a bookshelf, okay, and I'm going now to what we would call today the really middle class, because most poor people didn't have bookshelves. And if they did have bookshelves, they built them. But if people bought bookshelves, that bookshelf was expected to be in the family for the next 100 years. If people built bookshelves, that bookshelf was expected to be in the family for the next 100 years. Even when necessities such as plates were purchased, those plates were taken care of by the family to the extent that, you know, it was not a little occurrence when mom handed off these plates to daughter at or after the wedding. It was considered a great pride to the family. They had an enjoyment of these things that the marketing companies had not yet broke. It took post-World War I measures to break that cycle. So overproduction was a real concern because the capacity to produce was so great. And the unwillingness of the population was so high to actually just buy that captains of industry said, look, I don't, you know, if we overproduce, it's going to cost to really floor, and we're going to have a really big issue. So there was a lot of discussion on how to deal with overproduction. As I said, now after World War I, they developed mass, mass manipulation techniques. I mean, it was marketing and advertisement put together with psychology and sociology and all this other stuff. I mean, it took psychology to a whole new level after World War I. And they started pushing people to want to buy. Part of the increase in the early 1920s of buying stock came from this new way of selling stocks to people who ordinarily in the past wouldn't have even thought about buying stocks, didn't even want to get involved in stock ownership. They started marketing them differently with some psychological edges, and they increased the amount of stocks that people were buying who had disposable income, who before were like, no, I'm not a stock man or woman, you know? So that changed. That changed. Now, modernly, obviously, we have the flip. We've reversed that. Now, it's not about overproduction. It is about underproduction. Even greater than that, with the mass-produced culture that we have, we know that there are flaws that are built into every product to make them obsolete after a while, to make them break down, to force the user to have to actually go and purchase another one of those gadgets or gadgets which are produced. However you may feel about that, it becomes even more stunning when you look at what this means for things that, you know, we really don't have to constantly get rid of. For instance, we do not have a way of reusing masks in the hospitals. So we have a problem now that we have less masks than we need. Now, we should have a way to reuse masks. There was a time, if I remember correctly, that you used to use cloth masks. Now, we have all kinds of fiber technology now. We should be able to produce a cloth mask which is not only beneficial and helpful to the professionals who are using it, but also that could be sterilized and reused. Why don't we have that? We don't have that because it is more profitable for corporations to force hospitals to buy one-use masks. It may be a little bit more difficult for us to say the same thing with gloves. In fact, I'd probably say it is more difficult for us to say the same thing with gloves. But a lot of the PPE equipment that is used, and all of us know what PPE is, at least who don't work in offices and skyrise buildings, that's personal protective equipment. All of the PPE that is used, most of that should be able to be sterilized and reused. However, because of, again, the profitability of using one-use stuff, we don't do that. Which is now proving to be problematic because, ladies and gentlemen, you know, I've listened to a number of people who are familiar with infectious diseases and a number of people who are familiar with this infectious disease talk about what this disease is looking to do in the upcoming future. And the best case scenario that I have been able to find is that the disease peaks in about a month, goes away for the summer, and comes back for, you know, around two, sometime in the autumn, maybe petering out early next year, 2021. That's the best case scenario. The worst case scenario is, and I don't like this one at all, but I'm going to tell it to you because this is, you know, we should have these things in the back of our minds. The worst case scenario is that this is a two-year process where you have hills and you have valleys. You have hills, you have valleys. Now, this is not to tell you to panic, because that's the worst thing people are doing is they're panicking. I'm going to talk, well, we really need to take some moments right now to figure out where we've come from as a society, as families, as communities, and where we want to go in the future. Because when this is all over, we're going to have some major choices to make. The Chinese government is already signaling that they understand this. One of their, I think it was their economic minister, actually said that his concern now is that this virus is going to end globalization, which has benefited the power rise, or the powerful rise, of China. Which is a problem for them, because if things change globally, which it's going to, ladies and gentlemen, I don't even want to pretend about that. If it changes globally, then China's going to be massively impacted. But that is for another day. Oh, trust me, that's for another day. I want you to focus on the other side of this. I talked about underproduction and overproduction. Now I want you to focus on something else. In the span of 10 years, the United States toppled two very entrenched dictators, Mr. Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein. Toppled both of them. There is one thing that both of these men had in common, other than the fact that they were trying to dump the petrodollar for gold. Saddam Hussein actually dumped the petrodollar for euros. And that was one of the things that PO'd Bush Jr. and encouraged him to go to war with Saddam. But there was something else. Now, I'm not praising either one of these men, even though I like some of the things that Gaddafi did do because he did try to take care of his people. But there is a couple of things that we have to look at which actually PO'd, and particularly one thing, that PO'd the Western world. If I remember correctly, Saddam Hussein had developed a crony network. And it was a crony network. I mean, if you were in the out party, then you weren't getting, you know, one of these major contracts. But he developed a system of 170, I believe, domestic companies that provided the staples of the Iraqi diet and the needs of the Iraqi people. Wasn't perfect, but he did this. This severely cut down the economic influence of Western societies. Because Western societies, what they do, and it's, you know, no big secret, is they entice you with, we're going to bring in corporations, going to give your people jobs, they're going to, you know, feed your market, things are going to be great. Those corporations don't really make things great, and that's how they control you, is by getting them in there and then, you know, allowing them to do what they do. By not allowing Western societies to influence him economically, he cut down on their ability to actually lob really good threats. Now, that didn't mean that he wasn't vulnerable. Obviously, they didn't produce everything that society needed. There were many things which still could be cut off in war, cut off from the society, which did cripple it and hurt it in many ways. But for the majority of the population, the majority of the population, they received what they needed from these core companies. Gaddafi had something similar. It wasn't as extensive as Saddam Hussein's, but he still did have something similar. Now, we in the United States used to have core companies that would manufacture and produce what was needed primarily for the American people. There were obviously things that were brought in from overseas, but primarily we could still produce the things that the society needed. Obviously, you see where I'm going with this. One of the primary suggestions that I have heard from various individuals looking at what is happening with COVID-19 and the shortages that have resulted from it, including shortages of medical equipment and what have you, is that a lot of these companies who sell to the American market, but yet have their supply chains, including their production facilities, overseas because they can pay, you know, pennies on the dollar of what they're selling, that a lot of those companies need to bring those supply chains, particularly manufacturing, when, you know, possible, back to the United States. Basically, they're calling for a repatriation of probably 30 or 40 million jobs from overseas. And, you know, maybe on the lower end, 20 million. But think about Apple. Apple, which produces its iPhone over in China, it probably could bring back 20% of its workforce, productive workforce over there, or production workforce over there, and create, what, 200,000, 300,000 jobs easily? Easily. Walmart made its name in the 90s, in the early 2000s, by forcing companies to close facilities in the United States and move them overseas. And yet we're expected to worship Walmart in this time of great need because they're stepping up and doing things. Well, if it wasn't for them in the first place, and I should never forget that Walmart lied in the 1980s through the early 1990s saying that all of their products were made in America. But we're supposed to pat them on the back and embrace them and say that they're a good American company. They are not. They literally caused hundreds of thousands, probably even millions. I'm going to forget that probably. They caused millions of jobs to go overseas because they wanted lower prices to put other people out of business. We forget about this, but it's the truth. They wanted to do this to put other people out of business. And when I say other people, ladies and gentlemen, I'm talking about your main street. I'm talking about grocery stores. They promoted the race to the bottom very rapidly and very quickly. You do not worship them. Neither should we worship many of the dollar stores. Even though they're doing good jobs, many of them are doing good work right now. But they too have promoted this race to the bottom concept of, you know, production. Millions of jobs have went overseas because of these entities. Because of these entities. There is going to be a national conversation, I believe, that is going to demand these companies to bring a lot of these things back to the United States. Here is where China comes in. Because China sees this getting ready to come up. They see it. They're not stupid. They see it. If the United States starts going down the road of less bring back 2 million jobs from China, China, or, you know, it's not just going to be the U.S. That's the big thing. It's not just going to be the U.S. I guarantee it. So if the U.S. says, let's bring back 2 million jobs from China back home, let's bring back, you know, 1 million, 2 million jobs from other Asian areas, let's bring back, 500,000, 600,000 jobs from Mexico, China may actually respond in a aggressive way. Because if the U.S. is able to bring 1 million, 2 million jobs back from China, that will not be the end of it. They know this. Because they know, look, they're trying to keep their population afloat just like we're trying to keep ours afloat. And part of the Chinese strategy clearly is that they would be the mass producer and the American public will be the mass consumer. Now, as China moves to a position in the 2030s where they're not only going to be able to support their own productive capabilities, but also consume their productive capabilities, by support, what I mean is have enough ability to balance out productivity and consumption and waste. They're not quite there yet. They still have to, you know, get their society to compulsively consume. They're getting there, but they just don't have enough of it yet. So as they move to that in the 2030s, then they will be able to let a number of American firms go. But right now, they can't afford that. So I want you guys to really prepare yourself for really what's going to be the second phase of this thing, because it's not just going to be about, the COVID-19 and the aftermath in the United States. There's going to be an economic discussion, which is going to have international consequences. It's going to have international consequences, and we have to be ready for that. Because, and I really hate to put this out like this, the United States has $20 trillion worth of debt. It's likely when this whole COVID-19 thing is done, we're going to be somewhere between $25 and $30 trillion in debt. That's more than the GDP, the national GDP, the average yearly GDP of the United States. Donald Trump has already sunk $2 trillion into Wall Street, into trying to prop up Wall Street. He's already done that. He's going to have to sink another $5 trillion or so into Wall Street. Guarantee it. And that doesn't even talk about what he's going to have to do for the rest of the country. The $1 trillion stimulus package that they're talking about isn't enough. Too much reliance on tax credits, which do nothing. They do nothing unless they're directly targeting small and medium-sized businesses. And most of them will not. They're going to go to the bigger guys. he will have to implement for at least a little bit of time. He will have to implement a UBI. He will. And I'm not talking about a UBI where it benefits the middle class, which I, what they're trying to do with the one-time payments is disgusting. But I'm not talking about that. He's going, you have to put money into the lower classes because the lower class is really where your economy gets its boost from. I know people like to think otherwise, but the lower class is really where your economy gets their, gets its boost from. Because we make so little down here, and technically, they don't count me as low class, or lower class anymore because I make more than $20,000. But we do make so little that we spend it. We spend the majority of what we get. You give somebody who is out of work, who is a lower class worker, you know, one of these gig economy folks or one of these people working at a restaurant or what have you, you give them $1,200. The majority of that is, half of that will go to bills. The other half will go into the economy. You give it to them repeatedly, 6 months. I'm saying even after they go back to work, you give it to them. They're going to pay down a significant portion of their debt, and then they're going to put the rest of it into the economy. Now, here's the fun fact about all this, and it's not really a fun fact, because this goes to China. If the U.S. starts to make noises, the U.S. government starts to make noises, signaling that they are going to push for manufacturers to bring their businesses back to the United States. I'm not talking about 150,000 jobs, guys. I'm not talking about 500,000 jobs over 4 years. China can withstand that. No. If they're signaling that they're going to push manufacturers to bring 1 million jobs back in a year, 2 million jobs back in a year, 3 million jobs back in a year, 4 million jobs back over the course of 4 years, maybe even more than that, China's going to pull an economic move that is dangerous. China is going to pull an economic move that is dangerous. That's why they're forcing their people to go back to work. That's why they're forcing their people to go back to work. And I'm trying not to get on that real quick. I want to finish this thought. They're going to pull an economic move that is dangerous. It's a move that the U.S. actually pulled on Great Britain. I think it was back in after World War II, where they're going to call in their loans. And when the U.S. is like, shoot, I don't have $30 trillion to give you. I mean, I think China owns like, you know, $3 or $4 trillion or something of around that. When the U.S. is like, I don't have that to give you, they're going to put their boot on their neck and say, put their boot on Uncle Sam's neck and say, look, you ain't got the money. That's great. Don't play with us. We got the productive capabilities to surround your country with an armada. We are the first country in the world that could ramp up production well enough where we can threaten your military prestige. Don't play with us. Leave those jobs and everything's going to be fine. Try to take those jobs and everything's not going to be fine. Play with us. That's what they're going to do. This is why they're forcing their people back to work. Because with countries, not only just the United States, going through massive shortages of various goods, which are produced in China. They know if they don't get on top of this, and these countries start ramping up production of these medical supplies and what have you in their own countries, China is shut out. China will never regain that business. Never. That's one of the reasons also why I believe Donald Trump hasn't forced companies to start producing goods in the United States. Because the moment it happens, the moment you put 100,000 Americans back to work producing these goods, people are going to say, why should we ever let them go? And then that's going to cause a broader conversation about why should we have these things offshore in the first place? These are perilous times, ladies and gentlemen. I don't say that lightly. This is going to change the global economic world. The global economic world. I'm sorry, guys. This is going to change the global world economic structure. Completely. It's going to. Already you see people online having these discussions, not only just in the United States, but in Europe and elsewhere. What critical things, what critical supplies, what critical needs should be produced in each country? And that's a heck of a conversation that needs to have, because this is something that I've been talking about to people, not you guys, unfortunately, for some time. And I should have been talking to you about it. That is really my bad. I should have been telling you that we should have a core set of goods that have to be made in the United States. Goods that aren't connected to the military. It's time to get beyond this idea that the military is the most important thing in this country. It's not. The military is there to protect the society. Well, if the society is in such dire straits, where you're having problems finding people who are in shape enough to actually go into the military, then the military isn't there as a productive entity anymore. It's just there. Because the society itself is so degenerated. It's as if a body is sick and there's an overproduction of white blood cells. The white blood cells are going to do more harm than good. So we have to start focusing on the actual health and well-being of our body politic, which at a cellular level is the individual and the family. That's what we're going to have to do. We're going to have that discussions and say, what type of things do we need to keep our society healthy? And how do we do it? How do we make sure that that is homegrown? How do we do it? And then we do it. And then we do it. Look, guys, China knows this is coming. They know this is coming. They are pushing their people to work because they see this coming. The sad part about that is it could cause more infections. I'm hoping not, but it could. Now, I want to end today's, you know, this will definitely be a short broadcast, with a little bit of information that I've been kind of toying around wanting to tell you guys. Anyway, as soon as I saw this thing unfolding as rapidly as it's unfolded over the last 2 weeks, something jumped into my mind. I watched a video, I believe it was in 2015. I watched this video from this brother, and I've mentioned him on this show before, named Lee Brown. He's a Hopi member, I guess. He's part of the Hopi tribe. And he produced or was a speaker on a very, very popular, like 1986, 1985 VHS tape that was dubbed and put online, which told kind of the origin story of the Hopis and the prophecies that went along with the origin story. Well, in 2012, he was speaking at some rally. It was a small rally, but he was speaking at the rally, and there was a little clip of that that hit YouTube, and I watched it in 2015, and he said something which was powerful, it was powerful. He said that the U.S., the United States economy would be humbled. It would be humbled. That it's inattentiveness, and I'm going to use my phraseology, not his now, its inattentiveness to the needs of its people, its inattentiveness to the needs of the mother, the great mother, what we call Earth, will not continue. That the U.S. economy would be made to submit itself to the will of the Great Mother, to do the ultimate good, to do the greatest good. And I thought about this. I thought about this as this was unfolding. And then I looked back at what had transpired over the last 8 to 10 months. Even the last 2 years, with the rise of Greta Thunberg, a Swede, which is important. Why? Because in the Hopi text, in their origin myth, there are four great places where the four great human tribes come from. The Hopi homeland is one, Tibet is the other, Kenya is the third, the fourth, Sweden. The fourth is Sweden. There is an activation that has happened from the great European heartbeat, capital, boom, Sweden. That's why Sweden looks so different than the rest of Europe. That is the heartbeat of Europe. They would do well to listen to him. But there is an activation from there. That's Greta Thunberg. To do great works. By the way, we don't exclude South American indigenous folk. That's why they're fighting in Venezuela right now. Because, you know, Bolivia, Venezuela area. That's important, but that's another day. Bernie Sanders, his call for a social justice platform, which is from the Franklin Delano Roosevelt playbook, social democracy, New Deal era type democratic stuff, and getting screwed, that's another story. It is something to think about. Coincidence, is it? To think about how Sanders' electoral downsliding has coincided with the upswing of this pandemic. A man who has called for universal health care, has called for the reinstatement of many New Deal era programs, on the downswing, right as Congress is being called into action to essentially put into place some of the things which he has been calling for. Obviously, Andrew Yang's concept of universal basic income is also in there, but I always have to warn people that his universal basic income came with an asterisk, which was that he wanted to slash most other safety nets. So I don't celebrate him for that. Andrew Yang knows how to do math very well. He likes to say that. But it's clear that his mathematical skills are mentally intellectual only. They are not emotionally intellectual. They're not emotionally intellectual. And that's a problem. That's why I don't support his UBI. That's why I don't support his UBI. There was that one time where I thought, yeah, this is a good idea, man. Yeah, Dr. King was for UBI. But Dr. King wasn't for this. Mm-mm, bait and switch there. Libertarian concept. Mm-mm. So all of this is connected. And from a metaphysical standpoint, I see, you know, I started off by saying, well, I didn't start off by saying, but I mentioned, you know, that we have to really intake We have to really intake where our community is and where it's going, where our nation is and where it's going, and what role are we going to play in that? And I'm not joking with that. This is, you know, there's an astrological alignment which we are in the middle of right now, and it's about to supposedly be over. And the fact that we're being drawn inside is telling us that we have some difficult choices to make, and we have to do some much needed reflection. The year 2012, ladies and gentlemen, we heard a lot about it. The world's going to end. The world's going to end. The world's going to end. That is not what the Mayans said. The Mayans said that there is a gate opening in the end of 2012. That was December 21st, 2012. That gate, which we started going through in 2012, we don't come out the other side of that gate until December 21st, 2020. It's 8 years. Eight is a powerful number, y'all. Completion. One aspect of it. We don't come out the other end of that until December 21st, 2020. And then we go into a whole new phase for 10 years. Then we go into another new phase for 10 years. Then we go into another new phase for 10 years. And it depends on what we do during that previous time, which is going to then set us up for the following 10 years, obviously. But there's a magnifier to it. So what we are able to accomplish in the first 10 years will be magnified for the second 10 years. That will be magnified for the third 10 years. And then at the end of that 30-year period, new era dawns. A new era dawns. A powerful era if we are ready for it. A destructive era if we are not. Because the mother will reset herself. And either we will be capable of maintaining her requirements, or we won't. And if we aren't able to maintain those requirements, then we'll be destroyed, and this whole thing will be started again. But if we are able to maintain those requirements, we continue on with a higher spiritual wisdom than we ever thought was possible in this human form. This is a beginning. This is a beginning, not an end. Now, I'm not really going to get into it, but there are going to be many things that are revealed over the next 8 to 10 years about those who are in charge of this country. And there is going to be some days in this country and this world which, you know, many people are going to be looking at and going, holy crap, what is this? Realize something, ladies and gentlemen. We all chose to be alive at this moment in time. We all did. There will come a day when I'll talk more spiritual stuff with you guys because I think it's necessary. But we all did. We all chose to be alive right now. We're strong enough to get through this, and we're strong enough to do the work that must be done. This is a test. It is. It's a test. It's not a test that, you know, you'd wish on your worst enemy unless you really hated them. But it's a test nonetheless. And most of us will survive it, and most of us will pass it to go on to the next one. But I'm getting ahead of myself with the next one. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you know, you can always reach out to me, guys. Please stay safe. We're locking down over here in New York. I know you guys are locking down over there in Cali. Somebody get the Lieutenant Governor of Texas on the phone and smack him around a little bit and tell him to start testing people, for Christ's sake. Not only testing people, but, you know, take some productive actions before stuff really gets out of hand down there. You might want to do the same thing in Florida. But, you know, Florida is... God bless Florida. Just God bless them. you know, but stay safe, guys. Really, stay safe. We're going to make it through this. We're going to make it through this. We are really going to make it through this. Like I said, though, we have some important things to decide, ladies and gentlemen. We really do. I am your brother, Vyamir Adis. This has been Clash 4 Battlefield Podcast. I'll see ya on the next one.
There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone.